brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
SoftRep.com, on time, on target. This is the first time we're doing this way, where we have the recording going on that we're going to put up on YouTube and playing the elements, you know, from the board. But anyway, first time in studio with us, Jack Carr, author of The Terminal List and former Navy SEAL. Great to have you here in studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
First book right here.
Debut novel. There it is. Thank you guys so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us, or thanks for coming on our
show. Absolutely.
Especially in studio. It's always cool to actually meet you guys in person.
Yeah, most of the ones I've done, I've been on my computer at home. So this is it. It's cool to be in a studio with all the actual equipment here.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's just, it's a different experience when you're in the same room as the guys. So to give some background on Jack is a former Navy SEAL, served in SEAL teams 2, 5, 7, and 11, and Special Boat Team 12. So you're, I was going to say 20-year veteran or 19-year veteran?
20, so yeah, not 11, but 2, 5, and 7 were my teams. 20 years, and so 20 in a wake-up. And then I was out.
Why do I have a 11 from?
I don't know. Maybe it's a typo.
So correcting myself, 2, 5, and 7, but then Special Boat Team 12.
Yeah.
Cool. And this is your first ever book that
this
you're writing.
This is. Yeah.
I always thriller genre.
To, yep. Always wanted to do that since I was a little kid. So as my time in the military was coming to an end, it was time to transition out and figure out what that next mission in life was going to be. And part of that was, well, a big part was taking care of my family, and the other part was finding that next thing that I wanted to do. And the two things I wanted to do from a very early age were, one, be a SEAL, serve my country in uniform, and second thing was to write fiction in this genre.
Super
so
cool.
Gave it a shot, and here we are. On Soft Rep Radio.
And, you know, I think it's super cool because, I mean, I had like the kind of the same thought when I got out of the military. I was like, I've read so many novels, like, and I have, you know, a military background. Like, why don't I translate that experience into like giving like some authenticity to a novel? And I mean, you have spent 20 years in the Navy, pretty much all of it in the SEAL teams, or in Naval Special Warfare. Yeah. I mean, you have like a real depth of experience to draw on and inform your work.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't my intention that one would lead to the other. Two completely separate things. It just so happened that as I was transitioning during that last year, as you know, once you drop your papers to get out, it's like, okay, you're off the track you were on, and now it's time to figure out how to administratively separate from the military, which it seems like you're the first person to ever do it. That's my experience anyway. And that was time to figure out what I was going to do next, so started writing. And as a kid, I transitioned from whatever, young adult books into actual adult fiction probably around fifth grade, I guess. I naturally gravitated to the same types of movies that I liked, you know, those movies that had things that had to do with what I was going to do later in life, which was hopefully become a Navy SEAL. So I naturally gravitated towards books like that too. So the Tom Clancy stuff, David Morrell, Nelson DeMille, and then later Stephen Hunter, and then later on Brad Thor and Vince Flynn. But yeah, I naturally gravitated to that kind of fiction. So I always knew that that one day I'd write it. And then while I was in the military, it just made sense. My mission really was to study the enemy, study where we were going, study their politics, their religion, their culture, lessons learned from guys that had been there before us, that I could make the best decisions I could under fire. And it just so happened that all that study translated well to writing fiction once I got out. So a lot of my research was already done by both the experiences that I had and the things that I'd studied.
And it's a hell of a lot more fun than writing like policy memos in the Navy.
I'm done with all that. I just wanted to do this, write fiction, and the second book, just finishing that up now, and
that'll
be out next spring. It's called True Believer, and excited to keep going down this path.
Well, let me ask you, as you know, guy who had a totally legit career as a Navy SEAL, what are the things in fiction, whether it's in books or movies, that you see and you're just like, oh my God, they're like, that's completely wrong. Why are they doing that?
Well, I try not to watch movies or read books with that eye, because it's I want to enjoy them. Mm-hmm. So I don't, but I do see that stuff and then kind of just try to push it inside and enjoy it for what it is.
Right, as an action adventure flick.
Exactly. Yeah. So if I'm reading a book and all of a sudden someone takes the safety off their Glock or something like that, I try just to brush over that real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And just move
These
on.
These are not continue. The droids you're looking
exactly.
for.
Exactly. I want to continue to enjoy the story if it's a good story, and it's just. It's a minor distraction, so you won't find any of that in the terminal list. The same thing in movies. You know, you find, you know, people are shooting and never reload, or they do it the wrong way, or they don't go behind cover or whatever else. Yeah, so it's I wish I could announce here on Soft Ref Radio what's going to happen as far as movie stuff. But the guy that optioned it for the movie is very excited to do
cool.
stuff and do it right and train and really you know, learn the tactics and. Anyway, we'll I think hopefully we can announce that in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
But, my goal would be that I know they get distracted in Hollywood very easily as well. But if they do go through with it and make the movie, you won't find the Infinimag.
Cool. That's super cool. I mean, a first time author and like already getting like some nibbles from Hollywood. I mean,
it's crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate.
Yeah. Well, when did this book come out?
So March 6th.
Okay. So it's been out for a little bit. What was like the genesis of this character in this novel? Like, you had a pretty good basis of what else was out there in this genre. And what was your take on it? What was your approach or your angle?
Yeah, so I put about five or six different ideas on the table and wrote about half a page to a page as far as just a synopsis, ideas, kind of free flow type writing. And then I looked at all those ideas, those possible storylines, and I picked the one that was the most visceral, the one that I thought would be the most hard-hitting out of the gate. And that was a story of revenge without constraint, really. And so that's how I wanted to enter this space, was as impactful as I possibly could. So that's the one that I focused on, and the title came very quickly, and then started outlining it, and just started writing. As you read through it, there are definitely some nuggets in there that only people that have been in the military will pick up on. So there's a few little hidden gems for everybody in there.
You draw on your experience, I take it, deploying overseas and so forth.
Yep, and I think that's why it resonated with Simon & Schuster, Atria, Emily Bessler books, is because it reads like there are real emotions that the protagonist is feeling. And that's because I tapped into experiences that I had in real life and just brought those emotions to a completely fictional storyline. So it ended up being a very therapeutic and very emotional story to write, even though it was fiction. And I didn't expect that at the outset. I thought, hey, I'm just going to write, you know, a good story that people are going to enjoy escaping into. And it ended up being a very personal writing experience.
Yeah, it's inevitable, you know.
I didn't expect that at all, and I think that's really that comes through with which is why it's doing so well, is because those emotions read like they're true because they are.
Well, the other thing too that only someone like you can really bring to the table is I think the way the troops interact with one another. And I don't know if this is like a solo vigilante tale or if, you know, it's about him interacting with his teammates also, but I find that in fiction, a lot of authors who never served in the military, they don't understand like the way we screw with each other all the time. You know, I'm sure it's like that. I know it's like that on a SEAL platoon because I work with those guys overseas. Same on a Ranger platoon or a Special Forces team. Like, we're always like, putting the screws to each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you try when you get out and you try to do that. Sometimes people are surprised when you get out in the private sector and start doing that same type of thing. Sometimes it doesn't play as well. Sometimes it doesn't, but not always. But yeah, so I think that that really resonates throughout the novel. And, you know, I got to explore a topic that I just gravitated to as a kid and still gravitate towards in movies and books that I like to read, which is that revenge thriller. And I wanted to have it be more than just a book about a guy who quote unquote has nothing to lose. Exactly. Yeah. So that was the first question I came to, was how do you make him already dead, essentially? How do you make him tap into that code of honor from the samurai Bushido, how they would go into battle thinking they're already dead because that they thought that made them more effective and efficient warriors. And how do I take that mindset and drop it into a modern day warrior? And that's where the conspiracy comes in with the government testing out drugs on our nation's most elite soldiers and having some side effects that they need to cover up that he then unravels and puts his list together and then starts working his way up that list. Not necessarily using just his skills, but using what worked against us in Iraq and Afghanistan and bringing those things to this country and essentially becoming the insurgent that he'd been fighting, becoming that terrorist that he'd been fighting for the 16, 17 years that he'd been in the military. So, and then escalating it with each and every hit that he does on this soil.
So it's a role reversal.
Exactly.
And what is the protagonist's main background?
So it's very similar to mine. So he's a prior enlisted SEAL sniper that becomes an officer and is at that point in his career where he is his deployment will be the last one where he tactically leads guys in the battlefield. And I knew what that felt like because after I got back from that deployment is when I decided to get on out of the military. So he's at that stage and he has kids and is deciding that, hey, it's time to move on and take care of them and leave this old life behind. And that's when disaster strikes both on the battlefield and on the home front, and then off he goes on his crusade.
Which I mean, it's not you're not wrong either. I mean, for a lot of guys, it's like the moment things slow down and you leave that life behind. That's where things start to come unraveled, and people have to reconstruct their identity in civilian life.
Yep. And it's everybody transitions at some point, in the military or professional sports or Olympic athletes kind of deal with it in the extreme because they've been so focused on something for so long that has given them a sense of purpose greater than themselves. Yeah. But everybody transitions from things at different parts of their life. And for us in the military, I think it's about really finding that next mission and finding that thing that gives us that sense of purpose and really identifying that. And then it allows you to answer yes or no to different opportunities that come along because you've essentially already figured out if you're going to pursue them or not because you've identified what's important ahead of time.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that we interviewed Nate Boyer yesterday. Yeah. And we were like, oh, yeah, I know him. We did some charity
work. Yeah, Nate's great. That's great. We did something with the Special Forces Charitable Trust. That they do a lot for the families of guys that really didn't make it back. And that anyway, great organization, all about helping the guys and their families. And we do a shoot every year for the foundation, and it's a sporting clays shoot where you don't win by how many clays you break, you win by how much money you raise. So it's a competition to raise the most money, and it's a lot of fun. And we were co-hosts last year, so Nate's a great guy, and he's doing amazing things for both veterans and guys in professional sports as well, and bringing those two communities together.
It's awesome. So can you give us a hint of where the series is going? You said that there's already a sequel that you wrapped up.
Yeah, so I don't want to give away too much, but I'll say that the characters from the first book, I don't want to say which ones, do make it into book number two, but which ones and in what capacity, that's the secret for book number two. That kind of leaves it open-ended at the, I don't want to ruin it for everybody, but the idea would be to have a series, and also I know you've had Brad Thor on, and he really opened the door to this industry for me, and he could not have been more generous with his time and his advice, and I would not be here today, living essentially this dream that I've had since childhood without him. And
not to mention high praise from Brad Thor on the book, as well as Chuck Norris of all people.
Chuck Norris, yeah, I got to have a great picture with Chuck holding up the book, and he's a fan. And I mean, obviously, I grew up, a child of the '80s. I grew up with with Chuck Norris movies and
Invasion USA.
Invasion USA, a classic. Lone Wolf McQuade, one of my favorites. The Delta Force, of course. Yeah, love it. He actually got my number and he FaceTimed me out of the blue.
Really?
Before I submitted the book, and he just called me out of the blue to say hi, and amazing. Yeah, absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. That was totally surreal. Cool. Yeah. And now they have a picture with him holding up the book, and just could not have been nicer. I've had so much support from everybody, both in and out of the publishing industry as I've transitioned. I feel extremely fortunate. That's for sure. But yeah, would not be here without Brad Thor. And in his latest novel, Spymaster, I was reading that, and on page 50, he actually mentions the Terminalist. He wrote it into the novel.
Oh, like the characters reading the book on the...
Yep, exactly. And what he didn't... Cool. What he might know it if he listens to this now, but I had already written Spymaster into my second novel in a similar way. So it's just funny how that happened. It was without any pre-planning whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, well, you're right. I mean, Brad has had an incredible run, and I mean, he's still going strong.
He's just amazing. Yeah, and he, for any would-be authors out there, he when we first talked, he gave me some great advice, and he said, give yourself permission to write a bad chapter. And for me to hear that, just I think I was about 4 months into my writing when we talked for the first time, and to hear that from somebody that had been so successful was very liberating. And he didn't really mean it's okay to write a bad chapter. What he meant was, you know, don't wait for everything to be perfect to sit down.
Otherwise, you'll never write.
Exactly. Yeah. Just sit down and do it, which is why that Nike slogan has stayed with us for so long. Just sit down, just do it.
Well, what is it that you've learned from him? Because there are so many thriller authors, and no one has had the longevity out there that Brad Thor has. And, like, what do you think that is? Because also, unlike you or Tony Tata, who we were talking about before, A.J. Tata, he is not a military guy, yet he consults with the guys to say, like, am I getting the dialogue right? Is the terminology right? You know, I'm just wondering from you, what did you learn from him?
Right, yeah, that first one, the give yourself permission to write a bad chapter, like I said, very, very liberating. But the most important piece of advice is something that, a lot of people already know, but it was nice to hear it. It was cool to hear it from him, and he said, the only difference between a published author and an unpublished author is that the published author never quit. And, to hear that from that obviously resonated with me because of Buds and how easy we make it for guys to self-select out of that program. Yeah. And, it's just in life in general, just never quit. So hearing that from him and hearing it about publishing was pretty cool. And then he said, hey, I'm not going to help you as you go along through this process, but, at the end of it, if you actually write a book, and I'm not going to help you at all, but if you do write one, I will, I'll let Simon & Schuster know that you wrote one and, let him know it's coming. So
that's cool.
That was, yeah, that's he opened awesome. The door, so he didn't even read it, he's read it now, but at the time, I think it's very
leap
safe.
Of faith.
Yeah, it's more, it was safer not to read it probably, because if it was horrible, then he could say, hey, I didn't even read this thing. he let Simon & Schuster know it was coming, and it ended up on Emily Bessler's desk at Emily Bessler Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster, who's Brad's publisher, and the next thing you know, we're off to the races.
It's awesome.
Yeah, couldn't feel more fortunate.
I'd love to also get into your actual Navy SEAL background, starting from, I'd have to look at my notes here, but 1997.
Yeah, I went to Buds in early 97.
Yeah, and, what was like the motivation to become a SEAL? I mean, I feel like everybody has a different story from Drago's been on here who literally like saw the movie Navy SEALs with Charlie Sheen and said, I want to do this to, other guys who just had adversity growing up. I think it's always like a unique story for you guys.
Yeah, Drago and I were on the East Coast together. So we were in Iraq together. Great guy.
An interesting character.
It's been a few years since I think the last time I ran into him was at SHOT Show about 3 or 4 years ago. But great guy. So I always knew I wanted to join the military essentially from my earliest memories. And my grandfather was in World War II, and he was killed on the aircraft carrier Bunker Hill in May of 1945 when two kamikazes hit the aircraft carrier. That day, he was a pilot, flew that Corsair, which was that plane with the gull wings that would fold up so you could fit them on the deck. And that first kamikaze essentially was a direct hit on the ready room. And he was never even found. He's still listed as missing in action. But I grew up with, and it almost sunk the carrier. It took it out of the war. It limped back to, I think, Seattle for repairs, but it never made it back to the war. So I grew up with his pictures of his old squadron, pictures of that plane, silk maps that they used to give aviators back then so they could get wet and wouldn't disintegrate if they hit the water, his old medals, his wings. So I grew up with that stuff. And essentially, even though I never knew him, he was a hero. And to me as a little kid. And then I think it was age 7, I found out what Navy SEALs were. So we were watching the back then, no remote control. I was a remote control for my dad during football games. And on Sundays, during the commercials, he'd look at his watch and say, go. And I'd run up to the TV, and I'd switch the channel from football to whatever movie was playing on the opposite station. And back then, it was usually a World War II movie back then. And so we'd have 2 minutes to watch that movie, and then I'd run back up, switch it back to football, and sit and wait patiently until the next commercial break. But one of those was The Frogmen, an old black and white film that showed guys crawling up over the beach to blow up obstacles. And I asked my dad, hey, who are these guys? And he said, those are frogmen. And I said, what's a frogman? And he said, ask your mother. And so I asked my mom, and she was a librarian at the time. And we went down to the local library that next week and did a bunch of research. And this was early 80s, so there's hardly anything.
Yeah, very little out there.
Yeah, very little out there. There's a couple mentions in a couple book chapters, a couple magazine articles. But my takeaway at age 7.
When did Dick Marcinko's book come out?
90s. Yeah, 92, I think, was the
book. Gotcha.
first Rogue Warrior. So this is a decade before that. Even earlier. And the takeaway was, hey, this is a pretty elite fighting force, and the training is touted in these articles anyway as some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military. So at age 7, they had me, and I was in. And I just kept my eye on that goal through junior high, high school, college, and then I enlisted after college because by then there's a little more out there. Marcinko's books, the first two anyway, had come out. There was a little bit more out there. There's no internet yet, but you could still, there were a few more books. Point Man was out there.
Some couple of other Vietnam ones. Yeah, exactly. Stuff, yeah.
Exactly. So that was starting to come out in the wake of Marcinko's first books.
I had like a similar experience. I think like the first time I ever heard of like special forces or special operations was watching, it was one of the Tom Clancy films that came out with Harrison Ford, where there's like this mission where the SAS goes into the desert.
Oh, Patriot Games.
Yeah, it's like a covert operation. They raid a terrorist camp and they go into the tents. And I remember I was probably 10 or something like that. And I'm watching this with my mom and I was like, Mom, what? Like, I couldn't in my mind make sense. Like, is this a war or is it not a war? What is this? And she's like, it's a secret mission. I'm like, can they do that? She's like, yeah. I was like, all right.
So you're a lot younger than I am. I think I was I was in freshman in college when that movie came out. But I remember the guy sipping the coffee, that's a kill.
Yeah, exactly. So, I was like, Patriot I want to be that guy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, I read so that all that both that fiction and then all that nonfiction that was coming out just kind of, you know, fed into what I wanted to do later and into my research. And through that research, I found out that most officers aren't snipers, and I knew I wanted to be a sniper. So even though I'd been to college, I enlisted because I wanted to go to sniper school, and ended up doing that with Brandon. Actually, we're in the same sniper class. Yep, same sniper school class. And I was back in 2000, so it was all Vietnam era type tactics were still. Yep, yeah, more of an art than a science.
I'm gonna have to mention this because you know it's funny. I was like, hey, Brandon, I did see him the other day. I was like, Brandon, are you familiar with Jack Carr? But I didn't, you know, Jack Carr is not.
I met with a SEAL yesterday, actually former SEAL, and Eric Davis was his instructor at sniper school. I was like, that's hilarious.
Nice. Yeah, we had a good time, but it was definitely more of an art back then, especially the wind calls and all that. But I would think now, especially with all the
instruments,
the advancements in technology, and then the experience that we've had since September 11th, I'm sure it's more of a blend of art and science at this point. But it would be fun to go back through today and see what they're doing, you know, 18 years later.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's changed tremendously. Just like GWAT era, mm-hmm. you know, the technology has grown in leaps and bounds, and like you said, it's more about the math now than like trying to like eyeball the wind calls and stuff like that.
Yeah, a lot more holds. Obviously, great advances in scopes and how they do it. It's incredible what I hear is going on out there today. So, pretty cool. And I'll be incorporating that into future novels, that's for sure.
So, what made you want to make that jump then to officer?
Yeah, so it was before September 11th, and I had some, let's say, less than stellar leadership in my first couple of platoons. And so I was like, hey, I can either complain about this or I can go the officer route and do it better than it was done for me. But truth be told, had September 11th happened in the spring of 2001, I would have stayed enlisted and gone that other route. But as it was, I had to make the decision in spring 2001. And when I got back from my first next deployment, off I went to OCS to fold underwear and t-shirts for 3 months, which somehow qualifies you to lead men into battle, and then right back to the SEAL teams.
Yeah. You didn't have to go through a some sort. I know they don't make you go through BUDS, of course. Thanks, second time, thank God. But do you have to go through some sort of like SEAL officer indoctrination?
I think now you go back through SQT, SEAL qualification training. I think it depends. Okay. I think there were. I didn't have to do that. I went right to the. Maybe it was because of what was going on in the war at the time, but I went back right back to the SEAL teams to see Team 2, and then I was out the door to Afghanistan within a few weeks, which was great because I got some experience very early on as an officer, and I just couldn't put a. It was a great experience, and then got back to Team 2, and then it was a couple of Iraq deployments after that. But it was a good run for being an officer. It was a good a good run. So I feel very fortunate to have been able to do the things that I got to do for as long as I got to do them.
Yeah, Ian was showing me your resume actually before, I guess the publicist shot it over to us, and he was like, I can't believe how many SEAL teams this guy's been on. And I was like, oh, he's an officer, so he kind of had to go to where the billets were.
Right.
But yeah, you had a totally awesome run.
It was pretty good. Yeah. For the timing was pretty good, which is a lot of it, of course. And yeah, great experience at all my teams. And but now I kind of look at it as, hey, that's something I did, and it's always a part of me. But now I write. And,
yeah.
I do some other things. I have some other businesses going as well. But I love writing. I'm so passionate about writing the whole process, coming up with the ideas and coming up with the outlines and figuring out the titles and then problem solving, just like we did on the battlefield overseas, but doing it in fiction now. So I'm just aggressively solving problems on the written page instead of downrange with the guys.
And
so
fiction is a really good place, I find, to explore ideas that you couldn't do as say a journalist or a historian or something like that. Or maybe it's just something that's very controversial, or maybe it's something that you're never really going to establish all the facts of. Sure. But fiction is a place where you can kind of explore different ideas and like the what ifs.
Sure. No, it's a great place. Great place for that. Great place to exercise some of that creativity and continue to, because that's what it is: creative, aggressive problem solving downrange. That's all it is. And doing the same thing here in the pages of these books is, I find it to be, one, therapeutic, and two, a lot of fun. And it's just, I feel, like I said, I keep saying I feel very fortunate, because I do, to be doing what I wanted to do since I was a little kid, and to have it working out the way it is it's beyond belief, really.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you about, just going back to military stuff, was that I saw that when you were in the SEALs, that you and your guys had worked with Iraqi counterparts. And I think a lot of people have this idea in their head that SEALs or Rangers, like maybe that's something SF guys do. I don't think they realize that, like, our entire military has basically been doing that in this war.
Right. The foreign internal defense thing has, we were doing it before then, and we'll continue to do it well into the future, I'm sure. But yeah, book number two actually takes an experience that I had working with the Iraqis downrange in like 2006, I think it was. And I took it a certain experience that happened, and I thought, hey, what if I just fictionalized this and made it a lot more interesting? So it is totally fiction, but the inspiration behind book number two comes from a real world event.
That's cool.
And then of course I totally fictionalize it and say, hey, what if this is actually a movie or actually a great book? How would that read? And
there'd be way more firefights for one.
Yeah, a lot more of that. Throw in some beautiful women. Some of that. So there's a little some conspiracy. You got to have some bad guys out there too at the highest levels of government. That's always fun. So
And last year I did some reporting from the Philippines. And when I went and visited NAVSOG, the Philippine SEALs, there's a American SEAL platoon there working with them and training them. And, I mean, those guys were doing great work out there. It's a very strong relationship between American SEALs and the Philippine SEALs. It's really cool to see.
Yeah, I got to spend a little time down there. And that's where I really, I think that was the first time I had more Army SF guys working with me than I did just SEALs. And, those guys have been studying unconventional warfare and studying, the culture and how to negotiate and do all that sort of thing from day one in the Q course, whereas ours is kind of after we do all the aggressive stuff, after we weed
out.
So it's kind of it's kind of the flip model. But I realized there was a great guy down there. I won't say his name because I didn't ask him ahead of time, but a great warrant officer in Army SF that was down there from First Group. And I realized that, man, this guy knows what he's doing. He has been studying this part of the world and studying unconventional warfare type stuff for a long, long time. And then that Army warrant course for SF guys is awesome. And I just learned so much there. So that's when I started catching up on some of my studies, rather than just best way to kick in a door and take down a target and all that stuff. And so just kind of opened my aperture quite a bit. And the Philippine Marine general in charge of our island became like a mentor to me. That's how I worked that relationship.
Which general was that?
What is his name? I'm forgetting his name right now. He actually wrote a thesis that's on my bookshelf. Guerrero.
Was it Saban?
No. Guerrero, I think.
Guerrero?
I think that was his name.
No, I don't know him.
But, great guy, and I just learned a ton from him. So I just said, hey, I'm kind of I'm here to learn from you. And I got to learn a lot on that deployment that actually found its way into the pages of the book, because that was That's the time cool. I could take a breath and actually study in the environment where these guys have been countering this insurgency for, you know, 100 years plus now.
Oh, yeah.
So they know what they're doing.
And Philippine Marines are great. They're like so, in so many ways, they're like a mirror image of U.S. Marines. Like you could take a Philippine Marine and put them in the American Marine Corps, and like you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Have the same haircut. Yeah. Same stature.
No, exactly.
Same attitude.
Exactly. And just living out there amongst the populace down there, I learned a ton. So, and it was great preparation for my next deployment to Iraq, because then I had even more Army SF guys. Then we were in those four southernmost provinces of southern Iraq for the drawdown and eventual withdrawal. But it was great preparation for that. And I've always had a great working relationship with Army SF. So, it was a good run.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then you went and did your you had to go do some staff time at the training center.
I did. So when I got back, that's when I decided, hey, it's time to get out. But I still had a few years left till I hit that 20-year
right,
mark.
Right.
So actually, the timing worked out very well for me. So even though I decided to get out when I got back from that deployment, because up until that point, I mean, what you owe it to the guys is to be solely focused on the mission at hand. That's what you owe them, their families, you know, the mission, the country. But I found when I wasn't taking guys downrange and was now moving to the training command as the ops officer. So essentially, for people non-military listening, it's like a COO of a company, just running day-to-day type operations. I had time to take a breath and think about that transition. And I know a lot of guys don't get that. A lot of guys come right off a deployment and then say, hey, I'm getting out, and then they just have a certain number of months, possibly a year, to make that transition, but they haven't had the time to take a breath and really look around and explore what their options are, and maybe intern at a few places to really understand, okay, if I get out of the military and move on to this other sector, what is that really like? Is it different than I've read? Different than what I think it's going to be like? Different than the movies I've seen about it? So to really be able to explore their options, I had that time. Right. A lot of guys don't have that.
We interviewed Todd Apolsky a few weeks back. He was a Marine, went served in JSOC, and then came back to the Marine Corps, and he was saying how fortunate he was, and that the last couple of years in the Marine Corps, he's writing like policy letters or something. Wow. He was doing doctrine writing, and he was like, it was great that I got to share some of that knowledge with the force, but I also had a breather behind a desk to start to get my life together before I retired.
Exactly. That was very beneficial, and being at the training command, I mean, that thing buds, it's a machine, and it's moving, so whether you're there or not.
It's grinding through human souls.
Exactly. Yeah, it's crushing souls daily, but the worst part actually was being, so my office was right there by the bell. So my door was always open because I don't think we had air conditioning, or it would go on at the wrong times. And was anyway, so doors were always open. So I always had a view of that bell. So I got to see pretty much everybody that would walk up and stand there and ring that thing and put their helmet down.
Wow.
And you just feel so bad for these guys, because you're like, you know, he could have had the same dream for the same amount of time that I did growing up. And now he's, you know, made the decision to not continue with the program. You can just see it in their eyes. And it's that's the toughest part to see. You know, you never.
Yeah.
You want the right guys to make it through, so it's a necessary part of the process. But, you know, when you see it, it's like, oh, man, that's just tough. And then, of course, the instructors just, they switch once you do that. And they're not the nightmares that they were up until that point. Because, you know, you want these guys to think, hey, well, and it's true that, hey, you can still go on. You can still serve your country. You can still do good things. Take what you've learned here and apply it to the rest of your life going forward. So make this a productive type of thing rather than a demoralizing
one. When I went through the Ranger indoctrination program, that was probably like the best tactic they had, because the guys who quit, they got to go sit by the fire, eat an MRE. And I remember one of the instructors coming and lecturing us like in the middle of a smoke session at like 3 a.m. And he was like, listen, men, you can get up and quit right now. Go sit by the fire. You can still be a good American. Still be a good soldier. Just quit. Your friends can't see you. You're all laying down in the dirt. Just get up and quit. Go on. That got more people to quit than, you know, push-ups and flutter kicks all night.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember being in buds in that surf, start of hell week, and everybody's just starting to quit in droves. And, sometimes guys would yell, hey, come back, don't quit. And I was always just kind of quiet because I was like, hey, the process is working.
Yeah.
I'm like, I liked it. Like... So I feel bad saying that. We edit that. But it makes me sound like a terrible person. But I mean,
you're being honest about, you know, the process and the job that you had to do. I get it. Especially while you're going through the process, you want to be one of those last men standing. I get it.
Because you can't have somebody who wants to figuratively ring the bell in combat. Like, you can't have it. And you got to trust that the guy next to you is going to stick it out with you.
So it seems to be working. And, you know, what we do have a harder time with is selecting for character. So it's easy to find that guy that can run really fast and not quit.
Yeah.
But how do you select for character? And I think
that's true across the board, I think.
Yeah. So I think the Israelis do a few different things where they actually get data points on that as the guys go through for, I think it's called, they probably changed the name, but, you know, Flotilla 13, their version of the SEALs.
Oh, yeah. S-13,
So they do things that, you know, they give a group of guys shovels or paddles and tell them, hey, dig a foxhole for yourself and dig one for the team here. And then they'll see which ones dig their own first and which ones jump in and do the group one. And
interesting.
Just a little data point. And so they do a few different things like that where they collect some information on character and can draw people for that.
I didn't know that at all. That's really interesting.
Yeah, we don't necessarily do that as well in our training pipelines. They might do it now, but you know, as of when I left, it was still push-ups, sit-ups, run, obstacle course, swim.
Well, you can see the strains on the military after 16 years of war that, you know, starting to fray. The ethics, the morality, things like that starting to fray a little bit. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's important to look at those things as well.
Yeah, at least data points and at least have the leadership has options if you need to get rid of somebody that is actually passing the course on paper, but it doesn't have that, for lack of a better word, team ability, doesn't have that piece that we're looking for, that intangible.
Well, that's why you have non-selects, right, guys, who like they we do it in the Army. I think the Navy does the same. Like, they can, like, board guys out. Like, technically, they made it through all these physical events, but, like, that guy's not a team player.
Right. So, yeah, I think we do something similar, but you have to generate a lot of paperwork. So sometimes guys do slip through, like in any.
Isn't that technically what happened to that Dan Bilzerian guy? I mean, he went through the whole training twice, right?
I believe.
I think I heard him on Rogan, and he talked something about something like that. And then, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I wasn't there at the time.
But I believe Brandon interviewed him for Safra.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, and he talked years ago. And I think he talked about that he, you know, made it through Buds, did the entire thing physically. And at the very end, I wouldn't know because this is not my area of expertise, but they were just like, this is not the right guy for the job.
Maybe, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I believe I was kind of revealed in the interview you did with Brandon.
I mean, I can tell you it definitely happens in special forces assessment and selection. You have guys who do well on all the physical events. They make it to the end of the course, but they're not selected.
Right.
They're not invited to come to the qualification course.
Got it.
And it's because the instructors see something.
Right.
And actually, they do a lot of team events in SFAS to see how you work with other people.
Right.
How do you relate to other people?
Got it.
People end up becoming non-selects because of that.
Interesting. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's probably the most a more important trait than if you run your 3 miles in, you know, 15 minutes or 16.
Yeah.
But how you deal with the team aspects of this and how you contribute. So that's really what it's all about is adding value to the team, and is this person going to add value when he shows up at a SEAL team in his first platoon? And that's what you're really looking for.
Super cool. Well, this has been great, and
I did want to ask one other thing though, and get into this.
Yeah.
I mean, was writing a fiction novel always a dream for you the same way that being a SEAL was?
Yep, pretty much exactly the same. I just knew that the military had to come first because you're kind of on the clock age-wise on that. So, I was definitely doing that first.
So then you were talking about the Philippines experience. While you were in the military, were you thinking, like, I'm going to use this at some point when I put out? Okay.
No, not really. It just happened to work out that way, that all that studying I did applies to what I'm writing now in a fictional sense, as do the experiences. But at the time, I wasn't, I didn't write, I didn't practice, I didn't think about storylines, I didn't do anything except really study the enemy and try to make our platoons and troops the best I could going downrange.
Well, because it reminds me of Brad Thor actually said this the last time he was on. You know, your first novel, you have like your whole life to write. you know, and then the second, like, there's a due date, you need right. to get it out that next year. So I'm wondering, like, is this book the dream that you had for many years? Like, this same idea?
This is it. I mean, it's although I wasn't thinking about it, what this became through the writing process is really that dream. Is that's it. This is the best I could do out of the gates for a debut novel. And like I said, it seems to be resonating with people. And yeah, I couldn't have scripted it better.
Like, when did that protagonist idea come to your mind?
I think it was December of 2014 or 15. After everything, the dates are in my elder years here. The dates are kind of blending together. But about a year before I got out, and
okay.
It was like, okay, now it's time to. I have time. I'm not taking guys down range anymore. And my only job now is to figure out how to get out of the military administratively. I seem to have a little more time on my hands than I've had the last 19 years, and I can start thinking about this. And so really, it came together fairly quickly. Just the idea for the protagonist's name, the title, and all that other. Those things came together fairly quickly, and then it was just time to write and continue down that path and problem solve on the written page.
Very cool. And then what other authors besides Brad Thor were inspiring to you?
Stephen Hunter, absolutely amazing. So he wrote Point of Impact, which became the movie Shooter
yep.
with Mark Wahlberg. It so happened that I knew him through his daughter, which was crazy. So so I got to reach out to him, and he wrote a nice blurb for the book. Couldn't have been nicer.
That's cool.
Just an amazing guy. And he's not on social media or anything. He's old school. But I think he writes some amazing things. And I've been a fan since I've been caught some college when I read Point of Impact for the first time. Of course, Vince Flynn's Term Limits is just one of my favorites, even though it doesn't feature Mitch Rapp, who is the protagonist of his next novels. All of them were great, but Term Limits in particular was his first one and his debut, and the one that he had the time to write without a due date. And some of that Charm School back, Nelson DeMille in the 80s, classic right there. Brotherhood of the Rose, David Morrell, also back in the 80s. But there's so much great stuff out there, and I think that's why everybody in publishing has been so welcoming, which is not how I thought it was going to be. You know, from the outside, starting into a new field, you think that the people that have been there that are established might keep you at arm's length and not want the new competition coming in. And that's what I thought. And it has been 180 out from that. Everyone has been so welcoming and so kind and generous with their time, because I think they realize that, hey, there's room for good books out there. And there's room for a lot of good books out there. So,
to have a dude with your background who served 20 years in naval special warfare, and, you're not paired up with a ghostwriter, you're a literate guy, wrote a book on your, I mean, that's...
So I do have a writing partner, so it's not a ghostwriter, but...
Okay, but somebody for the first book to help you...
Well, we're partners in it, and he's a great guy, and cause coming from that team background, I found it... So originally I wanted to talk to him because he comes from the pharmaceutical industry, which is not a very popular industry at the moment.
If you've been watching the news,
So I will refrain from naming exactly where he works. But there's a part of the book that deals with pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, cool.
And that's where the drugs and the conspiracy come in. So, but he's always wanted to write fictional thrillers since he was a kid as well. And so in talking, it just became so apparent. It was just natural to let's partner up on this, and coming from that team background, it really helps to discuss it with someone
right.
and be able to
bounce
talk
ideas
through
off.
Exactly. And so it's almost like if you create a piece of art and you unveil it to a crowd for the first time with no one else having seen it before, and
yeah.
then you hear the gasps of, oh my gosh, that's horrible, or whatever. So this way, you at least have another set of eyes that you trust
yeah.
on it ahead of time. You bounce ideas back and forth. You can problem solve together as a team. So, and he had no military background at all, but brings that pharmaceutical side of the house in there. He has a legal background as well, some lobbying background for the D.C., side of this, for
and
the political
that's
side of that.
When you're writing a
so
book,
it really made this a.
It's not an operations order you're writing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it really became a. It was a great friendship that's gotten even stronger because of the writing we've done together. And I'm the face of it, and I'm the front guy because of my background and everything else. But it really is a team effort. Yeah, and I feel very fortunate that I have that advantage.
You're also doing something that's kind of uncharted in that. I mean, there's so many teammates of yours writing memoirs. You're, I don't know if the only guy or one of the only Navy SEALs writing a military thriller, at least that I know of.
Well, Dick Marcinko kind of plowed right through that.
But I'm thinking of the GWAT veterans
right.
and stuff. I feel like it's all memoirs.
There are some people who, like Dalton Fury, he wrote a sort of, not really a memoir, but a book about his experience in Afghanistan as a Delta Force commander, and then he kind of segued into writing fiction. Actually, very good fiction.
But of the SEALs, I can't think of SEALs, yeah. anyone other than, as you said, Dick Marcinko is writing fiction, but, you know, like the guys we have on this show, whether it's Rob O'Neill or, you know, Brandon, all, you know, they've all written memoirs, and you're going a different path.
Exactly, and I had a great run, like we talked about, but you know, I would just want to focus on the fiction.
That's cool.
And plus, it is a little maybe a little saturated out there. And I get asked about that a lot. Hey, what do you think of this book or that book that a SEAL has written that's nonfiction? And I like to frame it as, hey, you know, that's that person's perspective of either a mission or his time in that profession of arms, and that's how it should be viewed, as that person's perspective, and it'll become a part. It'll be a first-hand account, one
of a larger historical record.
Exactly, yeah. And it'll be that person's perspective, and a valuable perspective as well. And there's also history precedent worldwide, not just in this country, of people writing about their military experiences. I mean, Grant has his memoirs, it's not a new thing. What is new is the exposure for that sort of thing from the social media side of the house, which is where a lot of people struggle with it, because there's just so many different ways and the guys can mess up that exposure.
Sure.
So anyway, that's what I think about the nonfiction books.
I think what you're pointing out something really important, though, that down the line, decades from now, we're going to be able to take these books, these firsthand accounts from different people, different soldiers on the ground, and we're going to be able to combine that with declassified documents, declassified drone footage. I mean, there's going to be such a plethora of information, especially from this war, more so than any other in the past, that you're going to be able to combine all of these and have a more accurate historical record than we've had for any war in the past.
No, I think you're right. The hard part is going to be sifting through all that data. That's going to be the challenge. And even though this was fiction, I still wanted to submit it to DOD because if you read that regulation about from the Department of Defense Office of Pre-Publication and Review, I just wanted to honor my former security clearances, so I submitted this to the DOD, and the next one is there now, getting reviewed, and they took out a few sentences. So fiction, I left them redacted in the novel, one, because I didn't want to have to try to write around them, or I didn't know if I had to then write around them and then resubmit and wait another month or two for them to get back to me on it. So I just left them redacted as they were taken out by the DOD. So they're kind of near the end of the book there, but they took out five or six sentences.
I mean, you've had a far better experience with DOD than I have. I mean, I wrote an article and it was interviewing guys who were in Special Forces Detachment A in Berlin. So it was like a 5,000-6,000 word article. That thing is still sitting with DOD on appeal. It's been years.
Oh, the appeal, they can take a while. I also didn't want to appeal anything because when I read how long it could take, they can string that out for quite some time. So I just left the redactions in. But
wild.
That's tough. That is tough. And I thought there was a different regulation that pertained to media and news, so it's not the same regulation that applies to memoirs and fiction, if you interpret that regulation conservatively. But there's another one that applies to people. That's why people can go on CNN or Fox News the day after they retire and talk about ongoing military operations without anyone reviewing it, because it's a different regulation. But
it's also, I think, the Department of Justice, just the rules apply differently if you have a certain rank. And if you were, say, you were the director of the CIA, like if it was a lower and underling that went on CNN and made those comments, like they could be looking at being prosecuted. But no one's going to, DOJ is not going to prosecute John Brennan, former DCI.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. I want to give the government as little as I can.
Yeah, no, I understand.
To,
yeah,
to come after me. So that's why I sent it in. And then, it kind of works. Makes it a little more mysterious as to, hey, what did they take out? And like, can I figure out what they took out here and all that? And I was really surprised by what they did take out, because it's there are things that are part of the national dialogue and easily Googleable. But
it's always
that's
weird.
Just how it goes.
Yeah.
And I was surprised at some things they didn't take out, actually. I'm like, this might be a little dicey. They couldn't care less about that. More the kind of the explosive stuff that I talk about in here. And I left
I left at least one major portion out so that a kid couldn't actually recreate some of the things that, that the protagonist does in the book.
It's interesting, too, the CIA Public Review Board, they, for some reason, they always take out the term special operations.
Oh, interesting.
They don't like that term, and they replace it with special forces.
That's odd.
Yeah, it is. I don't get it.
I remember in Rob O'Neill's book, SEAL Team 6 is blacked out.
Oh, big parts of it are?
No, just the words, SEAL Team 6.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As if we don't know what he's talking
about. What's that?
Well, that's the thing. Whenever we, not all the time, but a lot of times we'll interview JSOC guys, and they refer to, I served in the Army Special Mission Unit.
Right.
And it's like, when you say that, everyone knows what you're talking about. So, like, why do we have to dress it up?
What about the email I got where they were like, Ian, stop using the D word, the Delta D word. Force. I was like, really? Is that, I'm not allowed to say it?
Army Counterterrorism Unit. Like, come on, guys.
Let's see. So in the back of the book, I have a glossary of terms. They took a few things out of that. But if we go to the D, where's
the D word?
Yeah, here we go.
There it is, the D word.
There we go. So they took out this part.
They blacked out
a little part of that. Yeah. But they let me keep the word in there. So I could say the word. And then I said a classic 1986 film starring Chuck Norris, titled The 1983 Autobiography by the Unit's First Commanding Officer, and popular name for the Army's Special Blacked
Blum,
Out.
Blum, blum, blum.
So, yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. So, yeah, I always liked having, when I was a kid, I liked going, having a glossary of terms in the back of military books.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So,
yeah. Because there's probably, you know, a 10-year-old, 13-year-old kid who wants to read this, who wants to do what you did.
Yep. No, exactly. Next time, though, I'm going to mention it in the author's note in the beginning that there's a glossary in the back, because a lot of people have mentioned that they didn't know that there was a glossary in the back and they wish they'd known that ahead of time.
We're acronym heavy.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, I try to explain it as I go along. There's a few times in dialogue or whatever where it doesn't make sense to do that. And there's also a few little gems in the back there for people. So I didn't make it a cut and dry glossary. There's some from people that have been in the military or people that are semi-political, they'll find some humor woven into that glossary. So I wanted to make it kind of part of the storyline as well. As with the acknowledgments, I wanted to thank everybody that has helped me over the years and really took it as an opportunity to be able to say thank you to everybody that helps me and my family as we transition.
That's awesome.
Well, the book is The Terminal List. It's available everywhere books are sold. You could follow Jack on Twitter or Instagram at Jack Carr USA. And that's two R's in car, Jack, C-A-R-R, USA. The website is officialjackcarr.com. Wrapping things up here.
Hold on, one more thing.
Okay, yeah.
When's True Believer come out?
Next spring. So I think it's April 2nd is what's on the calendar.
So I'll
right
be
now.
Back.
Yeah, so that would be wonderful.
Yeah,
I'll be
absolutely.
Back here in New York. I'd love to come in and say hi to you guys and hopefully bring some movie news along with me.
That'll be awesome.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, awesome. And there's, you know, hope to see, like, more movies out with guys of your background where you're going to be there making sure, like, is the dialogue right? Are the action sequences right? Because you guys point it out all the time when you see these movies and you're, like, what, you know, Zero Dark Thirty is the one I heard the most criticism of, but...
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. All right, well, wrapping things up here, there's only one club out there with gear handpicked by Special Operations military veterans from several branches, and that, of course, is Crate Club. I'm looking forward to the future collaboration we're doing with NFW Watches for an exclusive Crate Club watch for premium tier members. That's coming soon. We have different tiers of membership depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us for you dog owners. Check this out. You're going to love this. We've just partnered with Kuna. They have a team of trained canine handlers picking out a box for your dog every month of healthy treats and training aids. It's custom built for your dog's size and age as well. The products are U.S. sourced, all natural, and they not only promote a healthy diet, but also promote being active with your dog. So whether we're talking a pit bull or a chihuahua, this is just what you're looking for. And you can see all of that at kuna.dog. That's kuna.dog. It's efficient for you. Your dog's going to appreciate it as well, of course. And that's spelled CUNA.DOG. Also, as a reminder for those listening and watching now that we're doing these YouTube videos, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country, Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel, and that's at specopschannel.com. Take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. It's only $4.99 a month. The iOS app is available, as well as the Android app. And with that, I mean, this has been awesome. Any other stuff that you're plugging? I know you were seeing some charity work. Anything else you want to get out there? Or
yeah, no, I think we're putting on the website the different foundations that I support that I've had some experience with over the years. But there's also, for the guys that are really into the gear side of the house, the website goes into some more detail on the guns and knives and my personal experience with those. So if anybody wants a little more information on some of the gear and weapons that are used in the book, then that's on the website.
Awesome. Well, this has been a pleasure. Loved having you in here, and love, you know, having guys on of your background, and yeah, really appreciate it. Thanks again for you guys for joining us for our first new setup of this YouTube thing. If you're watching on YouTube, hopefully you enjoyed it. We'll be doing more of these. Keep spreading the word. Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. For all of the great content from our veteran journalists, join us and become a Team Room member today at softrep.com. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio. And be sure to also check out the Power of Thought podcast, hosted by Hurricane Group CEO and Navy SEAL sniper instructor, Brandon Webb.